Thank you. Good evening, everyone. When we're considering the subject of God's solution to a world at war, the first question that springs to mind is the question, is the world at war? Now, this possibly isn't quite such a difficult question as it was when I first prepared this, and I must apologise that some of the factual information here isn't bang up to date, because a lot of things have been happening, a lot of civil unrest around the world in the last few months, in the last year or so. And I wasn't actually planning to do this talk tonight originally, so so some of the facts I haven't actually got round to updating, so apologies for that. There are actually a lot of wars going on at the moment, around 40, probably more, since I originally prepared this. See, in this country, we're talking about a world at war. Well, there is no world war going on in the sense of World War I and World War II. We don't have this country's army fighting in trenches, for instance. There are no air raids that we keep having to take cover from, as in World War II. Not around us, anyway. But we read constantly in the news. You pick up a newspaper almost at random and you can read of war, of war crimes, of attacks on people, of torture, of terrorism, of guerrilla warfare, which goes on seemingly all the time these days. And it's not so long since we had major terrorist attacks in the West. I've just put the dates on there, which will instantly mean something to you, I hope. So there are war-like activities going on all over the world at the moment. 40 wars. Now, these statistics come from a website called globalsecurity.org, which lists all the wars which are actually still ongoing at the moment. Like I say, this is slightly out of date, so there have been more wars started since the civil unrest in Kyrgyzstan. But you can see that's just the most recent ones in a list there. The list goes on and on. Lots of wars going on at the moment. Now, you see, the oldest we've got there, the earliest we've got there, is one that started in 1996. In actual fact, there is a war that has been going on for more than 100 years. What do we mean by war, then? Well, here's a dictionary definition. The waging of armed conflict against an enemy. Obvious, really. Fighting. Like the pitched battles of World War I, like the air battles of World War II, people fighting each other. Now, the second definition of war is possibly less obvious. A legal state created by a declaration of war and ended by official declaration, during which the international rules of war apply, although actual fighting may not be taking place. And of course, the war that we mentioned that's been going on over 100 years, they haven't been fighting each other for 100 years. A state of war was declared over 100 years ago. They have fought each other on and off during that time, but they've never declared peace. So the war has never been officially declared, closed and ended and finished. And that probably applies to a large proportion of those 40 actual wars. An active struggle is the third one, an active struggle between competing entities. Now, this can bring it down to a much smaller scale. It doesn't have to be nations fighting each other. This can be entities, can be anything. It can be neighbours fighting each other. Personal wars. We hear about intolerance, unrest, lack of peace of mind all around us. People taking other people to court over seemingly minor issues. They're fighting for their cause, and they're fighting against other people. They're struggling actively against somebody they compete with. Fourthly, a concerted campaign to end something that is injurious. Now, we're familiar with this idea as well, a war on poverty, which generally seems a good idea. Poverty is a bad thing. We declare war on it. We say, effectively, we're going to stamp out poverty. Like the tagline, make poverty history. And the war on terror, George Bush's war on terror that he started with Tony Blair. this means force applied in the belief that your point of view is right. Now, it just probably happens that we probably agree with both of those two, that poverty is a bad thing and terrorism is a bad thing, and therefore declaring war on those isn't a bad idea. But that's just, we only agree with that because we happen to agree with the cause behind it. Now, it could be that somebody declares war on something that we happen to think is right. In that case, they're believing that their point of view is right, and they're declaring war on the opposing point of view. It's fighting your cause, whatever your cause is that you happen to believe in, fighting for it and being militant about it. So, what are wars fought over? Well, again, this isn't too surprising. Wealth. You take over a country, you fight to try and take over a country because they are a wealthy country and you would like that wealth to be part of your country. Nationalism. My country is better than your country. I think my people are better people than your people, so I'm going to take control of your country and your people. Religion. My God is better than your God. You know, we know of holy wars that take place. Jerusalem is probably the most fought over place in the world, in a sense, in the three major religions fight over their territory, as it were. My God is better than your God. My God is the right God to worship, therefore I'm going to take over your people and try and convert them to believe in my God. Territorial gain. My country's not big enough. I want your country as well to spread out into. Resources. This really ties in with wealth. Gold, oil, whatever it might be. If a country is rich in natural resources, then obviously it's a useful thing to conquer so that those natural resources become yours and can make your country wealthy by exporting them. Imperialism. Seems quite an old-fashioned idea, but wars still are fought for imperialistic glory, the glory of my kingdom. Racism. My race is better than yours, therefore I'm going to wipe out your race. Of course, this has happened in many different cases, the most obvious and notable probably being Hitler's intention to try and wipe out the Jewish nation. Revenge. Your country attacked me, so we're going to attack you back. So what can be done about war? Well, the United Nations was set up largely to combat the problem of war, as other functions as well, but largely to combat the problem of war around the world. The picture on the screen there is a wall with this carving on it outside the United Nations building. Whatever else the United Nations do, they're quite good at statuary and having impressive statues outside their buildings. This inscription reads, "They shall beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. Nation shall not lift up sword against nation, neither shall they learn war any more." And that is actually quoted from the Bible, from the prophet Isaiah, which is why this wall is known as the Isaiah Wall. And that basically sums up their mission statement. Turning instruments of warfare, like swords and spears, into instruments of agriculture like plowshares and pruning hooks. These days we would probably say, "I'm going to turn my missiles into combine harvesters," or something like that. So what is their mission statement? Well, their mission statement document is quite a thick wad of papers. That's another of their statues, and the impact is brilliant, isn't it? You can see instantly what they're saying there. "We're going to try and stop war. The gun's tied in a knot, it can't shoot." Their mission statement is quite a thick wad of paper. This is taken from the front page. It starts in a fairly sort of poetical style, and then it settles down and sort of gets down to brass tacks a bit further on. But this is a summary at the beginning of what their mission statement is. "We, the people of the United Nations, determined, 1, to save succeeding generations from the scourge of war, which twice in our lifetime has brought untold sorrow to mankind." So that's their first statement, their first mission statement, to prevent war, because it's a bad thing. Secondly, to reaffirm faith in fundamental human rights, in the equal rights of men and women and of nations large and small. So their second aim is to give us reason to believe and to trust that we all have equal rights. Whoever we are, whatever nation we are, whatever religion we are, whatever colour our skin is, whatever, we all have equal rights. Thirdly, to establish conditions under which justice and respect for the obligations arising from treaties and other sources of international law can be maintained. Well, that's quite a mouthful. But basically what it means is that we want to make nations honour their agreements with each other. So if nations make any kind of agreements of peace or relationship agreements between those nations, that the United Nations wants to make sure that the nations honour those agreements and don't go back on them and don't breach their contracts. And lastly, to promote social progress and better standards of life in larger freedom, which is a fairly woolly idea, and basically they're saying that we'll do anything else that makes life better for more people if it's not covered by the first three. So that's their mission statement. Now, the document goes on to describe, in brief, in summary, how they're going to do it. So, number one, we're going to practice tolerance and live together in peace with one another as good neighbours. Now, this is talking about nations. Now, nations are made up of large numbers of people, obviously. I mean, this is very obvious, but nations are made up of large numbers of people, governed over by smaller numbers of people, governed over by even smaller numbers of people, governed over by a president or a prime minister or a monarch or a dictator or something like that. Now, all of these are people. And we know that people quite often can't manage to get on with each other and can't manage to resolve their own personal disagreements and battles that they fight, and are intolerant of other people who don't think like them, or don't talk like them, or who don't look like them, or whatever. So if the rulers of these nations are ordinary human beings, and we know that ordinary human beings aren't very good at this practicing tolerance and living together as good neighbours, then how are they going to get their nations to do it? Might be a problem. Well, let's move on. Secondly, to unite our strength to maintain international peace and security. Well, if you're going to unite your strength with somebody, then you've first of all got to agree with them. And even close allies, even nations which are closely allied to each other, disagree about fundamental things. Look what confusion we have in this country now with a coalition government who agree on some things, but what about the things they disagree on? It's causing all sorts of problems in government. Now, the Bible puts this very succinctly in the prophet Amos asks the question, can two walk together unless they're agreed? And it's a rhetorical question. The answer is obviously intended to be no, of course they can't. If you imagine two people walking together and they disagree about everything, they're soon going to part company and go different ways. They're not going to carry on walking together. So unless the nations can unite together and agree together, then there's no way they're going to unite their strength, because they don't all agree about the way in which they should unite their strength. They don't all agree about the way in which international peace could be maintained. So, again, potential big problems with that one. Thirdly, to ensure by the acceptance of principles and the institution of methods that armed force shall not be used save in the common interest. Now, reading between the lines, what this basically means is don't start a fight unless it's the only solution. Which, if somebody starts firing missiles at you, it probably is the only solution. So I can't see that that one can work either. Fourthly, to employ international machinery for the promotion of the economic and social advancement of all peoples. Now that really goes with the last point on the previous slide, where we're going to try and make everything better for everybody, which is obvious really. That's what most people would like to do, to try and make everything better for people generally. So, how are we getting on with these solutions? Does the United Nations solution work? This is a quotation from the 18th century philosopher Immanuel Kant, and it sums up mankind's solution to his problem of war between nations. He says, "Perpetual peace is no empty idea, but a practical thing which through its gradual solution is coming always nearer to its final realisation." In other words, we work hard to get better and better at getting on with each other until eventually we can all live together in harmony. That the world will gradually become a better and better place until it's perfect. Can you really believe that? Can you really believe that that is what we're seeing happening in the world? Here's a few statistics. There are more statistics than these. I've just picked out a few years there. Major wars. The United Nations defines a major war as a conflict which causes at least 1,000 battlefield deaths per year. So 1,000 deaths of the people actually fighting the war, excluding any civilian casualties. 1,000 battlefield deaths. In 1965, there were 10 major wars going on. In 2003, there were 15 major wars going on. In 2005, it had gone down again to 8 major wars going on. Since then, and I haven't added later figures in, but since then, it's gone up again to more major wars going on in the world. So, if you look at all the figures, you can see that it goes up and it goes down, but there is no general trend of the world getting worse with wars, or the world getting better with fewer wars. There is no general trend. It goes up and down, but if you averaged it out, it stays the same. So it doesn't seem to be working. The world isn't getting a better and better place. But look at this as well. Think about the civilian casualties. In World War I, less than 5% of the people who died as a result of World War I were civilians. All the others were all people actually involved in fighting the wars, the men in the trenches and so on. Today, there's still just as many wars that cause 1,000 battlefield deaths a year. So for every 1,000 battlefield deaths here, we're talking only less than 100 civilian casualties. But what about these days? 75% of those killed as a result of war today are people who aren't actually taking part in the war. They're civilians. They're non-combatants. So for every 1,000 here, look how many other people are dying. War's changed. There possibly aren't more wars, there certainly aren't less wars, but war has become something that affects more ordinary people. In 1516, Sir Thomas More wrote of a fictional place which he called Utopia, where there was peace and plenty, and where justice was done perfectly. Are we getting any closer to this ideal? Well, no, not really. If anything, we're getting further away from it. And there's war on all levels. We're not just talking about international warfare, as we said earlier. It's intolerance, it's militant attitudes to all sorts of different causes. They're getting more and more in the world. International distrust is rife. Nations increasing their nuclear capabilities and so on, preparing themselves in case they get attacked. And in some cases, preparing themselves possibly to attack. War is still here, and it affects more ordinary people than ever it did before. So, is there another solution? Well, let's bring this down to a very, very simple idea. Imagine two children warring over a toy that they both want. They both think for their own reasons that they deserve to have that toy. So one snatches it, the other snatches it back, the other snatches it back again. They fight over it. Each of them is responding to their own homemade rules, and each of them has very good reasons in their own mind why they deserve to have the toy. To get what they want. And sometimes the only solution is that a higher authority, the parent, comes along and makes them both obey his rules or her rules. Sometimes that's the only solution. A higher authority comes along and says, right, you're both going to obey my rules. Stop obeying your own rules. You do what I tell you. Now, this is exactly what God says he will do. In the prophecy of Daniel, we have all of mankind's nations, powers, kingdoms represented as an image. And then God's new world order is established under Jesus, as Daniel, as the vision showed, a stone cut out of the mountain without the use of hands, hurled down to strike the image on the feet, to knock it over, to grind it to powder. Daniel, in chapter 2 and verse 44, says, "In the days of these kings shall the God of heaven set up a kingdom, which shall never be destroyed, and the kingdom shall not be left to other people, but it shall break in pieces and consume all these kingdoms, and it shall stand forever." So it's a world takeover. All the different nations with all their governments and so on. They're all fighting each other, and they all think that their cause is right. And the only solution is for a higher authority to come and say, right, stop obeying your own rules, you're all wrong, you're going to obey my rules. I'm going to set up a kingdom, and it will be there forever. Well, we'll come back to that idea. Now, we looked at the United Nations and what the United Nations organisation is trying to do about the problem of warfare in the world and how it's going to do it. Well, let's do the same for what God has to say in his mission statement in the Bible. God plans to provide peace in every sense. Freedom in every sense. Freedom from war. That's the most obvious sense of peace, isn't it? That there is no fighting going on. That war ends. Could you turn with me to the prophet Micah in chapter 3? Sorry, Micah chapter 4. Now, this just happens to be, you'll recognise these words because they just happen to be the same words that the prophet Isaiah used in his prophecy. And that we saw on the picture of the Isaiah wall outside the United Nations building. Micah chapter 4 and verse 3. "And he shall judge," talking of God's future king upon the earth, "he shall judge among many people and rebuke strong nations afar off. And they shall beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. Nation shall not lift up sword against nation, neither shall they learn war any more." So they won't even teach people how to fight. There will be no military academies, anything like that. That's what God's mission statement says he proposes to do. He's going to end war. People won't make weapons, they won't teach war, they won't fight wars. Okay, secondly, God's going to provide freedom from fear, anxiety and worry. How? Well, let's read the next verse, verse 4. "They shall sit, every man, under his vine and under his fig tree, and none shall make them afraid. For the mouth of the Lord of hosts hath spoken it." So, every man sitting in an idyllic setting is the picture being portrayed for us here. Nobody making them afraid. Sitting out in the open, not fearing attack from anybody. That's the idea. So that's what God says he's going to do. Thirdly, he says he's going to provide one religion. And this provides another kind of freedom because there's so much confusion in the world. Who do we believe? Who is right? How do we know? A lot of people feel guilty because they might be worshipping God wrong, but they're not sure. Or they don't know whether there is a God, and they're not sure. And if there is a God, Do I have to do anything special to worship him? There's a lot of confusion around. God is going to solve that problem by providing one single religion. Look at verse 5. For all people will walk everyone in the name of his God, and we will walk in the name of the Lord our God for ever and ever. One religion. One God, one religion. Simple, straightforward. He's going to provide freedom from death. Now, there's lots of places we could look in the Bible that talk about God taking away death. In other words, giving people immortality. Just pick up one. We won't turn to this one. Proverbs chapter 14, verse 27 says, "The fear of the Lord is a fountain of life." It's like as water gushes out of a fountain. So, worshipping God provides a fountain of life itself. To depart from the snares of death. So it's like we're trapped in a snare which is going to end up in us dying. Because we're all mortal and we know that everybody dies. We're trapped in that snare. But God says he'll provide a way to escape from that snare and get out of it. Let's turn to Psalm 72, which we read together. Because this is all about God's mission statement. He's going to provide perfect justice. Justice where the judge knows what's going on in somebody's mind. So he doesn't need witnesses. He actually knows who is right. Which of the two opposing people is right in any court case. Perfect justice. This provides freedom from oppression. Because you can't take advantage of the legal system to beat down somebody else. Because the judge will know. Look at verse 2 of this psalm. Psalm 72, verse 2. He shall judge thy people with righteousness and thy poor with judgment. Righteousness means justice in an absolute sense, in a perfect sense. Verse 3. The mountains shall bring peace to the people and the little hills by righteousness. He's going to provide perfect justice. Verse 4, he shall judge the poor of the people. He shall save the children of the needy and shall break in pieces the oppressor. He's going to provide perfect justice upon the earth. Freedom from hunger and poverty he will also provide. Now this earth is capable of producing enough food for everybody on it. If it's managed right, if it's managed carefully, if it's distributed correctly. But of course, because we're all split up into nations, and each nation has its own agenda of what it's going to do, and it has its own wealth to consider, despite all the talk of charity towards poorer nations and so on, there is a mismanagement of the world's produce. But look what happens here. Man won't even be able to mismanage it because the earth will become so fruitful, is what God says. Verse 15 of this psalm. And he shall live, and to him shall be given the gold of Sheba. Prayer also shall be made for him continually, and daily shall he be praised. Verse 16 I want. There shall be a handful of corn in the earth upon the top of the mountains. The fruit thereof shall shake like Lebanon, and they of the city shall flourish like the grass of the earth. Handful of corn upon the top of the mountains. The earth will become so fruitful that even the most hostile environments will bring forth crops. And lastly, he'll provide satisfaction or freedom from unfulfilled desire. Now this is something that people generally suffer terribly from. A lot of people suffer from. Unfulfilled desire, that we never get the satisfaction that we expect to get from the things that we do. We have aims and objectives and we never quite meet them. Or if we do meet them, we feel we should have set them further away, so we move our goals and we still haven't got there. Or we reach our goals and find that it doesn't make us feel as good as we thought it would have done. Satisfaction. And we won't turn to, this is in Isaiah chapter 65, we won't turn there. But Isaiah chapter 65 verse 22 says, "They shall not build and another inhabit. They shall not plant and another eat. For as the days of a tree are the days of my people, and my elect shall long enjoy the work of their hands." They'll long enjoy the work of their hands. So the people will do something and they will enjoy it from then on. And many people think that the Old Testament is to be discarded because it contains details of the history of God's people Israel, and the fact that it reveals God as a horrible warlike God who's always bringing justice and fire and brimstone upon people. And that the God of the New Testament, revealed through Jesus in the Gospel, is a much more loving God. Well, there is only one God. The God of the Old Testament is the God of the New Testament. And when we look at chapters like the ones we've just read, and if you take nothing else away, read through these and see what God promises for a wonderful new world. God is a warlike God when he needs to be, and he will be a warlike God again. But these three chapters reveal him to be a God of peace. A God who can provide, who promises to provide the best for people on earth. So with the United Nations, we, after looking at their mission statement, we ask the question, how are they going to do it? Well, we ask the same question of God. How is he going to do it? We've already referred to Amos, where Amos says, "Can two walk together except they be agreed?" And we've applied that to nations, and that they can't get on with each other. So they're not going to unite unless they can get on with each other. Well, the same applies between mankind and God. Until mankind and God are like each other and agree with each other, then they can't work together. And God is perfect, and mankind sins against God. So they aren't agreed. So until man becomes just and perfect and righteous like God, there can be no absolute peace. Now, God is going to do this in stages, and it's not going to be easy, and it's not going to be done by the world getting better and better until it's perfect. It's going to be done, like we said about with children and a parent intervening, it's going to be done like that. The nations fighting against each other, warring against each other, like we see around us now, more and more. And then God will intervene and say, "Right, that's enough. I'm taking control now. This is how it's going to be from now on." So in Revelation chapter 16, we're not going to go into great detail in these because we have to pull quite a few bits of the Bible together in one go to build up the picture. So we haven't got time to turn them all up. Revelation chapter 16, it talked about a battle of Armageddon. Now, there is no such place as Armageddon. It's not talking about a real place. It's symbolic because the word means a heap of sheaves of corn in a valley ready to be judged or threshed. So God says he will gather all nations together to a place called in the Hebrew tongue Armageddon. Now the fact that, first of all, it mentions the Hebrew language suggests to us that it is something to do with Israel. In fact, it's all about Israel. And the nations are being gathered together, focusing on Israel, so that God can judge them. Now this is all based on the old idea of threshing, where they cut the corn down with a scythe, they gathered it all together into sheaves, into bunches, and they stacked them. Then they were taken to a threshing floor, where they would be beaten with a threshing instrument to separate the chaff from the grain. And then the chaff would either be thrown up in the air so it blew away in the wind, or it would be gathered together separately so that it could be stacked up into a huge stack and probably burned. Whereas the grain is taken away, protected, and put safely into barns. And this is the idea. Now, Daniel chapter 2, we saw the picture of the image representing man's kingdoms, and the fact that the stone hit it and then ground it to powder, and it was, Daniel says that it was blown away like the chaff of the threshing floor. The same idea. God is going to make a separation between different nations. He's going to judge between these different nations. Now, the next place we would have to go to would be Ezekiel chapter 38. Because this clearly describes two opposing confederacies. They're not armies of one nation, they're confederacies of several nations gathered together. One of them comes down from the north into Israel. It's made up of northern nations and comes down and sets its sights on Israel as a target. Another confederacy comes from the south and says, "What do you think you're doing fighting against Israel?" And these two groups of people, these two armies, meet in Israel to fight over Israel. And then God intervenes at that point. Like the idea of a parent with the children, God intervenes and overrules their authority and takes control of the situation. And this is where we would come to the prophecy of Zechariah chapters 12 and 14, which go into detail of exactly what will happen. It says in chapter 14 of Zechariah, it says that all nations will gather together against Jerusalem to fight against it. But God is in control. It says they're gathered together. Now, the nations don't know they're being gathered. The armies and their commanders don't know that God is gathering them. Each of them is making their own alliances. They don't realise that all these things are in the control of God in heaven. He's using their own warlike intentions to bring about his purpose, to do his threshing, his separation and beating out of these nations. Now, at that point, God fights against them. He sows the seed of confusion against them so that all these people who were united then start fighting against each other. And their alliances start to fall apart. There's examples in the Bible where God has done that in the past. And that's what he says in Zechariah that he will do again. In the middle of all that, he saves Israel. He protects his people, the Jews. And then the wonderful thing in chapter 14 of Zechariah is that it describes people who are left. All that's happened is that the nations have had their political and their military power taken away from them. All the people of the world are still there. Their armies have been incapacitated. Their governments are thrown down so that they no longer have the authority to govern the world, to govern their nations. And God takes control. Isaiah chapter 9 speaks of this new government. But again, we won't turn there. It says that of the increase of his government and peace, there shall be no end. So once all this sorting out of the nations is done, when God takes control, he can enforce his new world order onto people. And they will eventually realise that it is perfect, that it works, that justice is done, that there's plenty, there's no hunger and starvation, and all those other things we talked about, that there's no war. All that will be taken away, and people will realise that this is better than how it was before, and that God has brought about what he says he will. So does it work? Well, the difference between God's solution that he proposes and what the United Nations propose is that God actually has authority. The United Nations has actually no authority, if you think about it, because it's made up of member countries, representatives from different countries. So it's made up of the same people whose problems it's trying to sort out. So who has the authority? There is no actual authority in there. But God does have authority. And we can prove to ourselves that God has authority by becoming familiar with the Bible. because the Bible clearly shows that God made the world that we live on, and he's controlled it ever since. He's demonstrated his control by accurate prophecy. And you look at prophecies made by other people that aren't in the Bible, and sometimes they just luckily happen to more or less come true. God's prophecies are extremely accurate. Hundreds, thousands of years in the future sometimes, he predicts very, very specific things. And we look back at history and we can look at other history books other than the Bible, and we can see that exactly what God said would happen did happen. So God has proved that he has control. He says something will happen and he makes sure it does happen. The obvious example we've got on the screen there, Israel exists again. God said that Israel would exist again, that it would be scattered, the Jews would be scattered among the nations, and that they would then be regathered into their own country, into the land of Israel, and there they are, there we see them. God sent Jesus. Jesus is an accepted historical figure. Historians don't all accept that he was the Son of God, necessarily. They don't all accept that he could do miracles, but no true good historian who studied the subject can deny that there was a man called Jesus, and that the things that the Bible describes happening did happen. History ties up accurately with the Bible. Now, when Jesus came, he showed the way to be on God's side, which is what the whole of the New Testament is about. How to end up on God's side when the battles in the prophecies in the Old Testament come about. And also, in both the Old and New Testaments, we have prophecies that Jesus will return to the earth from heaven, and that he will bring peace and justice with him. So how does it affect us? John chapter 5. Let's just quickly go to this one. John chapter 5, this is Jesus speaking. He says in verse 25 of John chapter 5, "Verily, verily, I say to you, the hour is coming, and now is, when the dead shall hear the voice of the Son of God, and they that hear shall live." So that's the background to it. But come down to verse 28. "Marvel not at this, for the hour is coming," or the time is coming, "in which all that are in the graves shall hear his voice and shall come forth." So he's talking about the dead being raised to life again. "Those that have done good unto the resurrection of life, and those that have done evil unto the resurrection of damnation." So he talked about God judging the nations and sifting them and threshing them, as it were. Now, here we have a much more personal thing. The dead will be raised. So people who have lived and died will come to life again. People will be individually judged. Because there's two kinds of resurrection here, aren't there? There's people being raised to life, raised to the resurrection of life, and others to the resurrection of damnation or condemnation. So there's two kinds of resurrection. Both sets of people are raised, but then God decides, based on the way we've lived our lives, the things we've believed, our attitude to life, God decides whether we will remain alive forever and become immortal, or whether we will be returned to death again, to a complete unconscious, to a non-existence. But let's think about those who live forever. God has promised a wonderful world. That's his mission statement, a promise. He's promised these things. And all we have to do is accept what he promises us. We have to take hold of it We have to follow God. We have to learn to live as the kind of people that God wants in his new world. And if we don't know what kind of people they are, we have to read the Bible, and it describes for us the kind of people that God wants. And we have to try, to the best of our ability, to become that kind of people. And then God will want us in his new world. And so, when the time comes, and the final battles happen, we will be on God's side, hopefully, and not on the other side, which will end in destruction and death. But God promises life and peace, freedom from war, from all our anxieties and fears, from guilt and confusion, freedom from death. We'll live forever. Freedom from oppression and miscarriage of justice, freedom from hunger and poverty, and freedom from any unfulfilled desires. If you sit and think about those things, that's an amazing thing that God has promised. And the Bible shows that God can do what he says he will do. Thank you.